today we're going to talk about all the things. Edith. Today we're going to talk about. Edith, stop laughing at me. This is Unorthodox, the universe's leading Jewish podcast. I am Stephanie Butnick, and I am not joined by my usual co-host today. That's because we're doing something a little bit different. We are devoting this entire episode to Shabbat. First, we're bringing you another installment of Beautifully Jewish, our series celebrating the beauty of Jewish life. We'll be talking about all the things that make Shabbat beautiful, from the dinner table to the rituals to connecting with friends and family. And we'll be talking with Shabbat queens Adina Sussman and Michaela Ezra. Beautifully Jewish is brought to you with support from Lion Brand Yarns, a fifth-generation family-owned business passionate about helping people enjoy the pleasures of working with yarn and committed to creating a more colorful, connected, comforting, and caring world. And then, since we're talking Shabbat, we figured we'd go back to the source material, the Torah. In our newest Tablet Studios podcast, which launches this week, Israeli journalist Sivan Rahav Meir offers a weekly look at the Parsha, offering practical advice from our holiest book. We're sharing the first episode of Sivan Says right here on Unorthodox. Whatever Shabbat means to you, we hope this episode serves up some thoughtful and delicious fare. And now for our first course. Let's get this Shabbat started. Welcome back to Beautifully Jewish. I am Stephanie Butnick.
And I'm Tanya Singer.
And today we're talking about all things Shabbat. Of course, Shabbat is the day of rest from Friday night to Saturday evening. We Jews are basically commanded to just stop everything. There are specific rules about what you can and cannot do. There's all sorts of things like that. But for a lot of people, the hallmark of Shabbat is a dinner on Friday night.
It's not hard to picture Shabbat. Shabbat's a sensory feast. It's the sound of the match striking. It's the taste of the challah. It's that first sip of grape juice. It's all those things. You wait all week for that feeling of getting ready for Shabbat dinner. And every week we get to have this dinner that is so different from the rest of the week. Maybe my husband's working late. Maybe my kids are tied up with Zooms and things like that. Shabbat dinner is this commitment in our family. We know what's coming. We know we get to light the candles together. We're going to bless our children. We're going to have challah. I know the core family is going to be together in an unhurried, beautiful way.
So you said a few things there. You said unhurried, and then you said that the creation of this meal is something you look forward to. I do not feel either of those two things right now. I find that on Fridays, it's like a scramble to get everything done for work and then trying to get home. And then, you know, I have a little kid, so that dinner would start early. And so it's like, I don't feel that sense of calm. I feel like, oh my God, Friday afternoon is my time to do everything. And like, I find that Friday afternoon is actually like one of the most stressful times for me because I do want to be really present with my family on the weekends. And so, you know, before I had kids, I would work all, you know, you just like pick something up on a Sunday that you didn't finish on Friday. I have this real feeling of like, everything has to get done for work on Friday afternoon so I can have the weekend off. But then, oh, wait, I'm also supposed to like figure out a way to sort of like make that night special.
So I guess define special, right? I think I used to get rotisserie chicken when my son was little and we lived on the Upper West Side. And I think there was definitely a store-bought challah. There was no making challah. When you have a toddler, it's all hands on deck all the time from the second they wake up to the second they pass out. And once they pass out, I wanted to pass out. So I wasn't doing all the fussing that I do now. I have teenagers. They don't want to spend time with me most of the time. It's different. But I get that. I'll tell you my one memory of my son, who's now turning 21. When he was little, I know he did Shabbat because he used to call grape juice kiddush. And he'd say, more kiddush, more kiddush. So like sweet. That taste for Kedem grape juice, you got to start him young.
No, that's true. You know, I'm open about the fact that I don't, you know, traditionally observe Shabbat. But I love this idea of just like making Friday night a little special. And I'm like starting this episode with like the acknowledgement that I'm not there right now. And I want to be.
Can we use Shabbat as a metaphor for just having time to do something Jewish that feels really good? It doesn't have to be about rules of Shabbat. It doesn't have to be about some perfect ideal at all. It can just be about carving away some little oasis for ourselves, for our families. And I haven't figured it out. My Jewish life is very much in flux, but I know I'm going to light candles. And I know that's going to be a very calming moment. And I know that I'm going to bless my kids. I mean, my son is in Israel now, so that I don't get to do that. But there's a few rituals I know I can count on that just make me feel happy and proud to be Jewish. And those are the things that have kept us as Jews, not all this bad stuff around us.
That's beautiful. And I love that idea. I also keep coming back to this thing that Liel has said, which is like Jews invented the week, right? Like this idea of the week. And I like the idea of like claiming that and really saying like, this is ours, right? This is ours for the taking. And it's up to us what we make of it. And, you know, it's interesting. We've mostly focused on holidays here on Beautifully Jewish. And I think it's really special to look at this regularly recurring thing where every week we have a chance to be doing something a little bit more Jewish, a little bit more restorative and regenerative and all the buzzwords that we all want, mindful, all those things we get from so many other places. But actually Judaism has a really nice way baked into every single week.
It's pretty incredible that this is built in and it's our birthright and we get to have it and we get to do it in our own way.
And so with that in mind, we have a really, really special Shabbat excursion here. First, we're going to talk to Adina Sussman, who is the best-selling cookbook author. Her first book was Sababa. Her new book is Shabbat, Recipes and Rituals from My Table to Yours. She's the perfect person to start this conversation about Shabbat with us. Later on, we're going to also talk to Michaela Ezra, who is the creator of Ayin Judaica, which is a really, really special new line of embroidered challah covers and so much more. But first, here's Adina.
I'm Adina Sussman. I live in Tel Aviv, and I'm the author of Sababa and now the author of Shabbat. Our whole week was kind of leading up to Shabbat in our home. We were Orthodox Jews, and I called Shabbat sort of the North Star of my cooking life and also just of our family life. Everything was organized to get us to that point when we lit candles on Friday night. And, you know, I think I also really looked forward to that bubble, that Palestine time that Heschel talks about, where everything else stops and something is sanctified about this 24-hour period, whether it's religious sanctification or something else, there's something elevated, something different. And it was really just a time to connect and oftentimes over food at the table.
There's a beautiful part where you describe being blessed by your father and how that felt. And it reminds me of conversations I've had with friends about rituals and taking on more rituals. What would you recommend to someone who's starting to expand their Shabbat practice? Like, what would you think they should do first?
The whole idea of the book is Shabbat meeting a person where they're at in their life, in their Jewish life, even in their non-Jewish life, because I think a Shabbat is a concept that everyone can derive meaning and enjoyment from. But so whether you say the traditional blessing or whether you have something that you say that sort of creates a definition between a regular time and this special table time, this dinner time. It could be a favorite poem. It could be one of the traditional songs that you sing to usher in Shabbat. It's just something that's meaningful to you and the people in your life and your family, or that you make meaningful to them. You know, I think the repetition, I think especially children like really look forward to things that happen weekly, and whatever that is, that's, I think, would be a really great place to start.
Those are good habits to build.
So tell us what a Shabbat is like for you now in Tel Aviv.
So it could be a more traditional dinner with roast chicken and, you know, soup and all that stuff. But oftentimes it's something put together from the things that I bought from the shuk that day. And so it could be, you know, a bunch of fresh salads that I made and a large fish that I roast or grill and then serve to the group. In the wintertime, it's often like a cholent or a chamin, like a large format, long cooking stew that you assemble before the weekend and then put on the stove and let cook for anywhere from 16 to 24 hours. And then you kind of unveil it dramatically with everyone around the pot and sort of see what's inside. And, you know, it's a really exciting ritual, especially in the wintertime in Israel.
Something that made me really excited was the portion of the book about appetizers, about dips and salatim, and this idea of just like a table full of delicious small things to eat. So tell us a little bit about what we find there.
Yeah, I mean, that's often how our meals take shape. I always joke that Americans pencil in their spontaneity a month in advance, but Israelis really are, you know, spontaneous entertainers and gatherers. So I like to have a lot of these things around when people stop by. And also just because one of the things I think that I realized in writing this book about Shabbat cooking is that, you know, cold and room temperature food are amazing for entertaining. And I think we have this idea that everything has to be like piping hot or fresh to show that we just put a lot of love and care into it. And I actually kind of think the opposite, like this casual serving of things that people can dip into and take like whenever they hit the table and for a long time is really great for Shabbat, because the Shabbat meal in our house could stretch all afternoon.
So what are some things that people should always have around?
Like, I always tell people to sort of use like seasonal produce as the anchor for the meal, because I think it can be overwhelming to decide what you're going to make for Shabbat dinner. I feel like that's like the number one question. What should I make? You know, and I mean, first of all, my main advice to people these days is make less. I think we have this concept that you have to lay the table with like three different proteins and like homemade challah and 10 different salads and homemade dessert and all these things. And, you know, the book is as much a meditation on the cook having a beautiful Shabbat experience as the eaters and the entertainers. And like, I think a lot of times that means sort of dialing back a little bit and just making what's essential and what's delicious. So, you know, I think using vegetables as your base and inspiration, make a huge salad, roast something beautiful from something you get in your CSA box or you find at the farmer's market or the supermarket, let's face it, because that's where most of us are still shopping. And then, you know, fill in with a protein, like if, you know, one thing that everyone will enjoy, or if you have a vegetarian, maybe like make a little tofu or grain on the side for them.
I cannot thank you enough for that. Like what you just said is really resonant with me. My best friend is such a cook, and my kids grew up going in for Shabbat dinner at her house. And it's like, here's the lamb, here's the chicken, here's the beef. I made this. It's like, it doesn't end. And so my kids think that that's normal. It's really nice to know that like you giving me permission to make it simpler.
I also feel like when there are so many choices, people don't know what to focus on. You know, I want to make a few things and make them really well and have someone come away saying like that, you know, kabocha squash with, you know, preserved lemon dressing was incredible. If there are like eight different vegetables on the table and three proteins, it's kind of like you get like eating ADD.
Our joy matters too. Like our experience as the host matters too, which is like how liberating.
It really, it matters to me. I mean, I have really reordered the way that I do Shabbat to suit my schedule and my happiness, honestly. You know, I feel like you have to meet Shabbat where you're at and vice versa. Like if you decide that you're going to make a huge feast and that's how you want to spend 2 days, do that. But I always say that the perfect Shabbat meal takes exactly the amount of time that you have. Like that is to me the perfect Shabbat meal. It could be a roast chicken on top of potatoes and a beautiful salad. That is a perfect Shabbat meal. It's also about not feeling the need to have the house be spotless, not needing to be done cooking when people come over necessarily. I mean, I'm not suggesting like that horrible torture where someone's like, oh, we're just putting the chicken in the oven. And then it's like 11 p.m.
Everyone's
and you're
like
ready
starving.
To, you know, but like, just, you know, that I, you know, my mom always said that like, people like to see a little mess. People like to help. The best way you can make someone feel at home in your home is to allow them to help you. Ask them to set the table. Ask them to cut something. Ask them to take out the garbage. Whatever it is, just like involve them in the process. And then all of a sudden they're part of the family, you know.
Let's talk a little bit more about this table being different. Could you tell us about some of the objects, the Shabbat objects that have been part of your life now or growing up?
I got married, first of all, for the first time at age 45. And in my late 20s, my mom bought me a challah knife. And I remember being like a little bit like, oh, like, do I deserve one of these? And she sort of said, like, you don't have to be married to have like Shabbat objects, you know, like I thought that was pretty amazing of her. And it was her. It wasn't my dad. It was my mom. She bought it for me. So I have my mother's candlesticks, my late mother's candlesticks. My sister has our grandmother's huge silver candelabra that doesn't even fit in my house in Tel Aviv. Stephanie, you saw my house. It's not that big. And then, you know, a Kiddush cup. Sometimes we use our silver Kiddush cup. Sometimes we just use like a glass You know, you don't have to use a ritual object. That's another thing that people, I think, mistake, that they have to have all these trappings of Shabbat in order to make Shabbat. Like, it's really nice to have a challah cover, but if you have a pretty napkin, you can use a pretty napkin too, you know? And then, yeah, I mean, it's pretty, you know, candlesticks, challah board, or cutting board if you have one. If you don't have a challah board, I usually just use like a really nice wooden cutting board that I sort of reserve for like serving and styling and stuff like that. And the rest is like, I think, in the content of the dinner, basically.
I love it. I love the realness of it and the idea of shifting your focus from the perfection and the fussing,
yeah,
and making it about being in the moment with the people. And I made a note to myself, it's like, it's the family, it's the friends, it's the whole feeling.
Totally.
It's not about like picture perfect food.
No.
And I don't know where that happened to us, where we got, I don't know if it's got to go back before social media, but it's this is so liberating.
I also think that it's true, like somehow in movies and in, you know, American lore, like, if the woman isn't exhausted, then she didn't make an effort. You know what I mean?
Well, people say, I've been slaving over a hot stove,
right?
Right?
As though that's a virtue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, that's only a virtue if it makes you happy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is some satisfaction sometimes in just, you know, if you're making a Thanksgiving dinner, like, it's kind of like everyone's like moving towards this, like, you know, this apex thing. But if you really want to make Shabbat a regular part of your life, and a weekly ritual or even a bi-weekly ritual, like, do it in a way that feels sustainable. Because if you go all out and do a Shabbat dinner like that, like, you're not going to do it again the same way the next week because it was too much, you know, or too tiring for you necessarily. You know, I also have the advantage of, I live in Israel where Friday is not a work day. So I can get my challah going and then go to my coffee shop. Then I can punch down the challah and then I can go to the shuk. Then I can braid the challah and let it rise and go meet a friend and start cooking other food. But that's not the case in the United States. And people, my mother cooked in advance. I mean, she cooked a lot on Wednesdays and Thursdays. Also, because we were Orthodox, you literally could not cook on Shabbat. But I also talk in the book, there's an essay about sort of revisiting cooking as a form of relaxation and almost meditation. For me, it was a way to reconcile the fact that I do cook on Shabbat. You know, it's not like I have any guilt about it, but it's definitely something that I think about in contrast to the way that I was raised. And so it has allowed me to kind of, what I try to do when I'm cooking on Shabbat is like just be a little more intentional about it, maybe a little more quiet, have some gratitude for the ingredients and the bounty around it, and like listen to the sounds of cooking and kind of be one with what I'm doing in a way, of course, with, you know, the Unorthodox podcast in the background. But, you know, just sort of slowing down a little bit. Even if you just do it for one dish, like, it's really amazing, like, how that experience can be like.
So what's one thing someone could do this week, this Friday night, to make things a little different?
I would say either invite someone over or invite yourself somewhere. or get a meal going with some other people, you know, and maybe try and approach it differently than you did in the past. Take away all your preconceived notions of what it has to be. Divide the work with other friends or people. So I think that's a good thing to do. I think, you know, whether you keep Shabbat or not, like, trying to carve out a little quiet time. And, you know, as someone who's formerly religious, I always joke that Israel's so great because the country just does a lot of the work for you. You know, like, there's Shabbat feeling in Israel because you're in Israel. And, you know, the country takes a collective sigh, breath on Friday afternoon, and there is this quiet. You know, the buses stop and most businesses are closed and there's that quiet. And if you can create that palace in time somehow, like, just like maybe institute quiet family time for a little while, or just decide that you're going to do something for yourself for an hour, go for a swim or sit in the backyard or read a book or whatever it is. Like, a lot of times doing less or having quiet is a way to transition into like another mood.
I love that Adina is giving us the permission to sort of go easy on ourselves. And for someone who's just trying to create their routine, going all out the first time is actually, she's exactly right. It's like a recipe for never doing it again.
Totally. I love her whole idea of like one main. That's it. There's one main. You can have a bunch of salads. You can make them in advance. You can buy them. And ultimately, it's about being with the people. And that our experience matters. Just be in it with the people that you love.
Someone who's creating new family heirlooms is Michaela Ezra of Ayin Judaica. She weaves meaning into everything she does, from her beautiful challah covers to how she lives her Jewish life. Michaela lives in Sydney, but we overcame the time difference to get her on Zoom and talk to her. Michaela Ezra, welcome to Beautifully Jewish on Unorthodox.
Thank you for having me. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Michaela, we're talking about Shabbat today, and we wondered if you give us a little window into your own Shabbat practice.
Shabbat is really an anchor in our family and something we all look forward to every week. And I feel Shabbat changes and evolves in the different phases of your lives, but they're very much a time to spend with family. My kids look forward to it, that they know that it's coming on Friday, it's Shabbat. And so there is definitely a spirit of anticipation in the home. And we usually have a very relaxed Shabbat with my parents, with friends. And Shabbat for us is Friday night and Saturday. We really take Saturday as a space for our family to disconnect, sometimes go to synagogue and just be together.
And you've taken your love of Shabbat really to the next level, because now you have Ayin, this wonderful new collection of what started with challah covers and has become so much more. So will you tell us a little bit about these beautiful challah covers that you create through Ayin?
Ayin evolved also spontaneously. And I was in New York. I was pregnant with my first daughter and taking some time out from my job in the fashion industry. And a friend asked me to design her a challah cover that was made in Mexico. My husband's from Mexico and she loved the Otami embroidery they did there. So she wanted a challah cover that reminded her of that. And it sent me on this journey of exploring and working with artisan communities in Mexico and finding a way to produce these textiles. And what I didn't foresee happening was that this would be this amazing synthesis of my background in textiles, my love for Judaism and Jewish ritual and spirituality, and my affinity for working with artisans and bringing income to women who otherwise would not be getting this income, and sort of making a bridge in the world, because suddenly this community of women who are living on the Yucatan Peninsula, who are three buses and a five-hour drive away from the closest city that you would know, which is Cancun. Suddenly, here they are embroidering textiles that say Shabbat Shalom, and that's being used in Jewish homes in Israel and in New York and in Australia and wherever else they end up. And there's this beautiful, beautiful circular economy that is created, and it's a spiritual economy as well. And we get the opportunity to support these women and their families who otherwise would have no connection to us.
Can you describe them to us?
All of these challah covers are hand embroidered onto 100% linen. The signature Ayin design is a design that was inspired by the Garden of Eden. There is a tree of life in the middle, and there are birds, and there are outstretched humses on the cover and flowers, and the word Shabbat Shalom across the center. And the embroidery fills up the entire textile. The edges are hand finished and hand fringed. And so there's this real texture and dimension to them. And when you drape it over the challah, depending on the color you choose and the different colors of threads that are mixed up in that colorway, you just get this beautiful painting almost with threads that drapes over the form of the bread. And it tells a story. And that was really important to me, because I remember looking at my grandmother's challah cover, which was hand embroidered for her family in India. And to me, that is such a moment of visual nostalgia that I have, thinking of my parents' Shabbat table with this apricot satin challah cover and its teal blue fringes and the faded flowers embroidered. And I hope and I pray that when I'm creating these challah covers and they end up on a table, that they become part of the tapestry of that home and the story of that family. And one day, the children there or the guests there or the people there walk away And they have in their mind, together with the spirit and the feeling that they had in that home, this picture of the challah cover.
And, you know, when we met, you told me the story of why we cover the challah, and I loved it so much. I don't know if everyone knows this. I didn't know this. So will you tell our listeners?
Well, there are two reasons. The first one is that when the manna fell from heaven and came down to the Israelites in the desert, it was encased in two layers of dew. And the top layer of dew resembles the challah cover that we use today. So that's one reason. The second reason is because in the Torah, we mentioned seven species, which are the sacred species of the land of Israel, and they're mentioned in a particular order. And wheat is mentioned first, and the grapes are mentioned towards the end. Now, at our Shabbat table, we bless our wine before our bread. So essentially, we're blessing the grapes before the bread, which is reverse to the order that they're mentioned in the Torah. So as not to embarrass the bread or embarrass the wheat for being out of its rightful place, we cover it so that it's shielded. And we say first our kiddush, our blessing on the wine, and then we uncover the bread and we bless the wheat. And so we're so sensitive to wheat, how much more so we should be sensitive to one another. I think that's the deep teaching from this.
How do beautiful objects and even handmade objects change your connection to Judaism and Jewish practice?
I mean, there's something that's just so touching on a soul level about seeing the human mark and the human effort and the toil in creating an object, that the soul of that person who was part of the making is in some way imprinted on that form. You know, I'd walk in Jerusalem and I'd trace my hands along the surface of the stones in the old city, or I'd look at the streets where there's an indentation from where people would walk, and there's a slope in those beautiful sandstones. And I think, how many people walked here? What were they thinking? What were they doing? What was in their hearts in that moment? And how unbelievable that this physical object, this stone or this building, has lasted for so much longer than that human being who passed through it or who carved it or who built it. And yet we leave traces of our spirit wherever we move. And so for me, I think when I see a handmade object, there is this human connection there. And there's also this timeless connection, this sense that this human being will live and pass, and this object that they have created will tell their story to future generations and create that link for us.
I love that. And I love the idea that your footsteps are part of that story. And I think about how that connects you to the bigger Jewish story and all the work you do on social media. And it feels like it's coming from a place of great learning and wisdom. And I wondered if you could talk about where you find the truth that you're able to share.
Thank you so much for saying that. And my teacher, Rabbi Simon Jacobson, always says words from the heart enter the heart. So when I'm showing up, whether it's in person or here or on social media, I really try to go inwards and sense into what it is that I'm struggling with or feeling, and share that with authenticity and truth. And you use that word truth, emet, which has such a beautiful meaning in Hebrew. I think that that's our duty. I think that that's our duty as we show up in these spaces, to do it with honesty and integrity. And that is what will transcend all the other noise that we have around us. And it's very important when we're seeing so much that is alarming for us, so much that ignites our fear, so much that has us looking outward at what everyone else is doing. I really hope and try to make this space on social media one where we can turn back inwards and feel into, where am I right now? What am I coping with? And what can I do? Because when we're distracted and we're looking outwards and we're pulled by all of these emotions, this fear, this rising sensation, it takes our focus beyond us. So when we can come back inside and regroup and sense into what it means to be here, why am I here? What work do I have to do? What can I contribute? What am I feeling? we can take action from that place. And that action is going to be so much more lasting and so much more powerful than anything that's just reactive to the hysteria we see around us.
And in that context, Shabbat is vital, right? That time to stop and slow down and as you say, turn inward.
Absolutely. And for me, you know, I didn't grow up switching off my phone on Shabbat. It's something that has evolved as my practice has evolved. And it began, I would say, years ago with me just not looking at social media on Shabbat. Well, first it began with, I'm not going to write on social media. I'll look, I won't write. Then it began with, I'll switch off.
That's like a Talmudic loophole, by the way.
Right. Totally. And then I switched off social media, and then I switched off email, and then I switched off my phone completely and devices. And for me, it has been transformational. I look forward to that time so deeply. I feel a sense of release, no obligation. We use our phones in some way to be free because we can work from anywhere, but it ends up becoming our biggest taskmaster. So to be able to let go of that for one day is really profound and something that I am hoping to continue in my children's lives, because I think as children, to be able to separate is, you know, really a skill and a gift that they'll need going forward.
We're coming up on a special Shabbat this week where it is really important to try to hear the Torah read. And we hear the story of Amalek.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about that?
So we read this Shabbat, which is the Shabbat before Purim. We're all called to go to the synagogue and hear, in addition to the usual parsha that is read, we read this extra piece about Amalek. And we're told to never forget what Amalek did to us when we left Egypt. But then we're also told to blot out Amalek's name. So we're told two things. Now, who's Amalek? For anyone who's not familiar, Amalek were the descendants of Esau, Jacob's twin brother. And when the Jewish people left Egypt, when they had their moment of freedom and expansion, and they were tremendously connected to Hashem and strong in their faith, it was the first terrorist attack for the Jewish people. Amalek attacked the Jewish people from behind, from a place that they couldn't see. And they attacked first the women and the children. And it was such a violent attack. And it was so jarring for the Jewish people that we are told now to never forget that moment. And we're told that Amalek will arise in every generation and in some way try to surprise us or attack us in the same way. We're told to remember what they did, but then we're told to blot out their name. So there's some teaching in that, that we have to reflect on the experience and use it as part of our story. And use it to understand who we are and what we've been through. But we cannot dwell in that pain. We cannot live in the trauma. We cannot think we are that trauma. We have to come out of it and grow and evolve and be able to tell the story and thrive and build and pass it on in a way so that we can honor our past and remember the threat without it binding us to live a life of fear and worry and doubt.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about the blotting out the name and, of course, the connection to Purim and shaking your grogger. And so we're hearing the story, but we're countering it with joy. We're coming together as a community. We're hearing this old story, the Megillat Esther. We're giving out Mishloach Manot. We have to use joy as a way to reconnect and reclaim ourselves. And we can acknowledge the pain and hear the pain, but find a way forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Amen.
How can we turn to Shabbat as a way forward?
Shabbat gives us a chance to be present. And Adar calls us to increase in joy every day. And that is a really, really tall order when we are experiencing so much grief and so much pain and fear. And I always find if I'm really present to a moment with my children, to the water trickling in the drain, to the sound of the breeze, to something that's happening in nature, if I can really just focus on what's happening right now, I can have some spaciousness for gratitude to creep in and for joy to creep in. And really that is Shabbat. Shabbat is saying, be present, have that stillness with your family, with your loved ones, with your friends or by yourself. And Shabbat is the culmination of our 6 days, but it's also the source and the beginning for the next 6 days ahead. And so the way we fill up on Shabbat with our breath, with our spiritual nourishment, with our light from our Shabbat candles, with our bread from our challah, however we're filling up, that becomes our fuel to give and to use for the week to come. And as I said, from that centeredness in the beginning, from that centeredness, we work out what to say and how to act and where our activism will be and where our voice will be and how we're going to stand up for all the things we desperately want to stand up for in the coming week.
Words to live by.
Michaela Ezra, we are so inspired by you and we're so grateful for you for sharing this beautifully Jewish joy and thoughtfulness and beauty with us.
Thank you for creating the beautiful space to do that and the gorgeous container for us to be here and share these ideas.
That was incredible. Every time I hear Michaela speak, I learn so much.
And the accent doesn't hurt.
So if you've been listening, you know that Beautifully Jewish isn't just a segment on Unorthodox. It's also a community. We did a craft along for Israel. We've done meetups on Zoom and in real life. And there's so much more to come.
Yes, our community of Beautifully Jewish members has been hard at work making things for others. Hats for Israeli soldiers, dolls for hospitalized children. And we wanted them to have something they could make for themselves, to make their own lives more beautifully Jewish.
And what better place to start than Shabbat? We worked with artist Vicky Katzman to design a challah cover. It's basically a coloring page for all ages with a design silkscreened on organic cotton. It looks great by itself in black and white, but it's also something that you can spend hours, days, months embellishing as you see fit.
Tanya, I am so excited to get my hands on mine and to start decorating it under your guidance, but there's someone else I need to bring in to help me. Do you know what she's singing?
Life is a highway.
She's like, sometimes indecipherable. Oh,
nice.
But music transcends, you know? Okay, we'll open this. So, Edith, do you remember how you made this at Temple? Remember this? Do you know what it says? What this is for? It's a challah cover. What goes under here?
Challah.
Yeah. And so look, we made this special one for the podcast.
I see candles.
Yeah, you see candles. Do you see, what's that?
I know.
You don't know?
What I love about this challah cover that Vicky Katzman designed for us, it sort of has three levels. There's the bottom, which is the earth or your table. Mm-hmm. And so we have the candles, we have the kiddush cup, we have the birds hanging out by this flower that's growing up out of the earth. And then above that, we have the sky, we have the heavens, and in there we have this bird. It's flying, and in its wake is a rainbow, and then there's the sun and the moon.
I see Shabbat Shalom. It doesn't have your favorite letter in there. What's your favorite letter?
E-D-I-T-H.
E-D-I-T-H, all of them. But we're going to color this, okay? We're going to make this our own. We're going to decorate it, okay? So what do you want to use to decorate it?
This one.
And we should say here that this is something that Beautifully Jewish members do get, yes, as part of their Beautifully Jewish membership. But I really love this because it's not just like a kid's thing, right? Like, yes, we're sitting here with a little kid, but like, I'm finding this incredibly soothing.
This is a mixed media.
Yes, this is quite advanced. I love this. Like, this is a tie-dyed background that Edith, she has a vision.
She does.
And we just, you know, we
need to get out of the way and let the artist work.
Okay, which one do you want? Want red?
Yeah.
Okay.
Red.
So I'm here with my small child, making a new tradition. Tell me about your traditions with your family, Tanya.
We have a really nice Shabbat dinner. If I have time and I feel that yeast will be on my side, I will make challah. And my family then for the rest of the, well, we all do different things. I am a Shabbat regular at my synagogue. My husband is not a Shabbat regular. Our daughter is a late sleeper, so that takes her out of the idea of going to synagogue on Shabbat. And then there are usually naps involved, either Friday night after dinner or Saturday. There's some form of napping.
A nap post-dinner before bed. I love these little spongy things. This is really pretty, Edith.
Can mommy paint too?
Yeah, okay. Mommy's paint.
Do you like it?
Making the flowers green.
You're making the flowers green? Oh, wait, this is so much fun. Mm-hmm. I actually did my favorite thing this morning, which is label challah at the preschool. And I have this theory that, like, you're never more, I would say, religiously literate than when you're in preschool, wherever you are. Like, in many places, you go to the church or you go to the synagogue. Like, that's just who does the preschools. And I do feel like there is this, like, real literacy of, like, Edith's talking about, I mean, she's not talking about Tu B'Shvat, but they're, like, reading books about Tu B'Shvat, and it's very, very sweet. And it reminds you of the Jewish calendar in a way. Many of the parents might not necessarily think about those holidays or engage in those holidays, but it is really fun to have
I need a blue one.
Okay, I'll get you a blue one.
It's funny, when my daughter was a little older than Edith, probably 5 years old, she came home from Hebrew school and said, Israel's birthday's coming up, we need to make cupcakes. It's one of my favorite memories. We made cupcakes. We got the most really disgusting blue squeezy tube of frosting. And there are pictures of her with a bright blue tongue after eating this blue icing. But it was amazing. And, like, that's not something we would have done had she not had that connection to a Jewish school. I never would have thought to make cupcakes for Israel's birthday. And I wouldn't have talked about it as Israel's birthday. But, like, she came home using that language.
It's
and
so funny, like, elemental
thing. Isn't it sweet?
Wait, do you want to tell them what happened? Who was the Shabbat family last week? And Mommy and Daddy. And what did we do?
Candles.
We lit the candles. And what did we eat?
Challah.
Challah.
We're both coloring out the same piece of challah.
I'm doing it in pink, and Edith's doing it in red. Edith, you are so good at coloring. Do you love it?
Yeah, this.
Purple? Yeah, purple.
Why?
Why not?
Why?
Will you describe this for our listeners?
Yes. Yeah, so the most arresting feature is the challah. It's a huge, bright pink and red, like neon challah. It looks amazing. And it was colored jointly by the two of you, which makes it even more beautiful. I love it. Do you have a favorite song at school that you sing, a Shabbat
song?
Life is a highway.
Is that a Shabbat song?
What do you sing on Shabbat? Bim.
Bop. Bim. Bop.
Is there more?
Bim, bum, bim, 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 bum. Bim, 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 bum. Shabbat.
Shalom.
Hey.
Shabbat.
Hey. Shabbat, 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 Shalom.
Wait, there's a new start, a new part for us to do.
I love that. Edith, thank you for reminding me of that song.
I mean, I also love this idea that, like, now, because we made this together, like, I have an accountability partner here, right? Which is Edith, who is going to want to use this every week, rightfully, because this is amazing. And, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier. Like, it's hard for me to do Shabbat. As you can see, things move, like, very quickly. As you can see, listeners who are not seeing anything, toddler time is, like, fast, very fast paced, very fast moving. There's not, like, much break. But, like, to me, that we're doing something special right now in this moment is really amazing. But I also think hearing from Michaela and, like, reminding ourselves, like, this isn't just, like, unplugging, right? Like, we always like to say, like, oh, Jews invented unplugging. It's like, there's something spiritual about this moment. It is a break in many ways from, like, the news cycle and social media. And, like, there are many secular benefits to this break that I think was, I don't want to say they're unintentional, but they're sort of, they're add-ons. This is, like, a deeply spiritual pause. Edith gets a challah in her cubby on Fridays, and it turns out that the challah she gets is from a random kosher bakery deep in Brooklyn that my mother-in-law had growing up. And so she saw it here once, and she was like, she like had this like very real sensory memory when she saw the packaging, and she was like, I have to tell my sister. Like, it was like this really bizarre, amazing connection. So we have the challah. That's the good news, and it's delicious. I have, as you can see behind me, a series of candlesticks with all sorts of tapers. We'll do the blessings, and like that's what I'll do this week, and I'll try to make it a little different.
You're showing your real craft talent.
Well, here's the best part. I'm gonna use this one, and then I'm also gonna use my challah cover from Ayin, the beautiful one that Michaela Ezra designed. And I think that mix is exactly what it's about, right? Like the perfect thing I found and then the perfect thing I made with my daughter. I'm excited. I'll report back. What do we say on Shabbat? Can I say Shabbat Shalom, Edith? What do you say back?
Shabbat Shalom, hey.
Shabbat Shalom, hey. I love you, babe. Come a kiss.
Stephanie, I can't believe you get to hang out with a toddler all the time. It's just like so joyful and light and amazing. I didn't think about my phone once, and I didn't think about the challenges in the world. What a gift she is, and what a gift it was to be able to make that challah cover with you. Being with our families, making beautiful things, building towards some moment in time where we can have traditions together. This is what has brought the Jews through time, through these difficult moments, and this is what's going to take us through this moment.
That's such a beautiful sentiment, and it makes me realize, like, Shabbat is here for us week after week after week. And I think about something that Moshe Kasher said in our interview with him on Unorthodox recently, where he was like, I think Shabbat is how Jews survive for so long, because they were like, I just have to get to Friday. No matter what is going on in whatever country I'm in, whatever time period, like, just get to Friday. And I love this idea that it's this pause that we are given and we are expected to do. And so what I'm taking from all this, and I want all our listeners to take, is like, let's just do one new thing this week, right? Whether you never do anything for Shabbat, whether you do Shabbat all out, like, let's figure out one special thing that you could do to make it a little bit more beautifully Jewish.
Try to put yourself in Shabbat too. Make Shabbat in a way that's sustainable, that gives you the same joy you want to give everyone around the table.
I love that. And this week, I'm going to be sitting down with my family. We'll figure out what the food is, but we're going to light the candles. We're going to say the blessings. And we're just going to be there together in that moment. I'll put my phone away for the night. I'll do something new and different. And I just want to be there with my family and with Jews around the world and, like, across centuries. And I think that is the nourishment that we need as Jews in this moment. Tell us how you're making this Shabbat beautifully Jewish. Email us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or tag us in your photos on social media, #beautifullyjewish. You can find out more about joining our community at tabletmag.com/beautifullyjewish. For more from Adina Sussman, check out adinasussman.com. And to follow along with Michaela Ezra and her products, check out injudaica.com.
Discover the Ben-Gurion University MBA International Program, a one-year English language MBA designed for global success. Gain skills to navigate international business complexities, engage in hands-on experience by developing a startup idea, tackling real-world challenges. Led by industry experts, our program ensures personalized learning in Israel's innovation hub. Network with professionals, join entrepreneurship masterclasses, and embrace vibrant campus life. Start your transformative journey today with the BGU MBA International Program.
I'm excited to introduce our newest Tablet Studios podcast. It's called Sivan Says, Taking the Torah Personally. Each week, Israeli journalist and Torah scholar Sivan Rahav Meir discusses the week's Parsha, or Torah portion, with our own Liel Leibovitz, giving practical advice from our holiest book. Today we're sharing the first episode of the new show.
Hey there, I'm Liel Leibovitz, and before I even tell you what this podcast is called, and before I introduce you to its absolute star, I want to ask you a question. What do you think about when you think about the Torah or the Hebrew Bible, the five books of Moses? You know the one. I'm willing to bet that if you're not, you know, overly religious, you've just read a little bit here and there, you think, yeah, man, it's probably a smart book, probably a complicated book, probably kind of an ancient, archaic book. The purpose of this podcast, Sivan says, Taking the Torah Personally, is to convince you that there is no book more wonderful, more precious, more relevant to your life right now than that very, very old book. And there's no better guide to the world of Torah than the star of this show. She's an Israeli journalist, broadcaster, Torah teacher, mother of five, and all-around genius. Sivan Rahav Meir, welcome to your show.
Thank you very much for exaggerating, Liel. Thank you very much. It's not me. It's the Torah. You know, I'm not perfect, but the Torah is. And it's, yeah, it's super relevant, especially now during, you know, everything we're facing now together, the challenges we're facing together. And I think as a journalist for years, the best source when you want to cover Israeli reality, current events in the world, it's the best perspective. The best way to understand the world is to read the Torah and then look once again at the world and see new things. That's what we're about to do right here, right now.
Baruch Hashem. So look, we are just a tad late to the party. The Torah reading, we read the Torah in a weekly cycle of 50-something portions a week. Each portion is called a parasha, which is the weekly Torah portion. And we here will be following that cycle very, very closely. So before we jump right in, tell us, where are we? What's previously on Torah? What did we miss? Where are we in the great big story of the Israelites?
So we're starting the book of Vayikra, the third book. We just finished Bereshit, Genesis, and Exodus, Sefer Shmot. We are out of Egypt. And thank God the world was created. And our ancestors, they came to Egypt. And that now, after so many miracles and receiving the Torah at Mount Sinai and building the golden calf and building the Mishkan, our spiritual center in the middle of the desert, now it's, in a way, people might think it's the boring book. It's the book of, you know, the way things work on a daily basis, 40 years, walking in the, wandering the desert on our way to the Holy Land. We'll prove, okay? Be with us. And throughout the, you know, I think next 2 months, we will prove to you how fascinating Sefer Vayikra is. But today, there's always an exception, you know. As Jews, I think we must be connected to the real pulse. And what's really going on in the world right now in the month of Adar is Purim. Purim's coming up and we cannot ignore Purim. So every week, I think we'll discuss the parsha together. This week, you know, as an Israeli, I'm not so polite. Maybe I should ask your permission. If it's okay, I think Purim, we must focus on the real holy day. And once again, especially now, I think this year, everything, there's a new perspective, new meaning. Everything becomes deeper in a way. Everything we celebrate, everything we do, not just as Israelis, as Jews all over the world. So this Purim this year is extremely important.
Okay, I completely agree, but it's also extremely difficult because, you know, Purim is the festival of happiness, of joy. You're commanded to be so drunk that you can't even tell the difference between the great Mordechai and the evil Haman. Personally, being very, very drunk so as not to notice things is something I'm very good at. But, you know, a lot of us are still very much heartbroken and traumatized by the massacre of October 7th. Think that maybe, you know, maybe this year we should tone it down. Maybe this year we should even skip it altogether. So I want you to do two things. First of all, give us the short version. What is Purim for those of us who may have, you know, slept in Hebrew school? And then tell us why this year, before you give us the teaching of this week's episode, before you give us the real lowdown, tell us why Purim matters this year maybe more than it ever has.
People, you know, ask, how can we celebrate Purim? I want to ask, how can we not celebrate Purim this year? I spoke to, you know, all the time. I'm in touch with so many families, bereaved families, families of wounded soldiers, kidnapped young people that are now in Gaza, bereaved families, evacuees, people who are not, you know, from the north and the south, now in hotels in Yerushalayim or Tel Aviv. And they all say, we want to celebrate this year. We cannot ignore, we don't want to delete Purim, you know, it's part of the solution. Purim is not a problem. Purim, the solution we need. It's the remedy. It's the cure. It's what we're supposed to do. Now, if you see, it depends, you know, how do you see Purim? What is Purim? So as you mentioned, maybe, you know, in kindergarten, you think it's just a, you know, a tale about a queen and a king, Queen Esther and King Ahasuerus and the mean Haman, and that's it. It's just a plot. So that's it. I can definitely agree. It's not important. But if you understand the essence of the story, meaning, tell me if, you know, it's maybe it sounds familiar. There's ultimate evil in the world. Haman, Amalek, also Persian, Iranian agent trying to kill all the Jews in the world. Our answer is Jewish unity and Jewish identity, Jewish pride. And in a miraculous way, but no, I would say in a hidden miracle. It's like something rational, like, for example, 6 Days War, or for example, 3 years after the Holocaust, out of the ashes, Israel was founded. Do you see it as a miracle? I see it as a miracle, but it's also a very rational scenario. It's not something, you know, it's not like splitting the sea or seeing, you know, the 10 plagues. It's something else. So in a way, Purim teaches us to see the miracles in our daily life and to work on Jewish unity and Jewish identity and Jewish pride against an enemy that wants to destroy and in a way kill all of us. We are focused on the differences among the different sectors and the way we define each other. The enemy, Haman / Hamas, ISIS, they don't see the nuances. They see this entity called Judaism, and they don't want it in this world. And we must ask ourselves then and now, if ultimate evil sees me as its enemy, what's the message? What am I supposed to do? What's my response? I think it's extremely relevant right here, right now, you know, watching the Oscar from Israel, or the president of Harvard or MIT or Penn University, listening to the news, the commentators. Sometimes when I listen to sources, even in that White House, I think the message of Purim is extremely relevant if you want moral clarity, if you want to understand there's right and wrong, you know, darkness and light, and true and false, and you want to be on the right and bright side of history, read Megillat Esther and you'll understand the real news.
Amazing. And so it falls to you to teach us about Megillat Esther.
So first of all, here's the story, if you forgot, or maybe you're listening in for the first time. It's exciting. You know, I'm from Yerushalayim, from Israel. We are all familiar with the content of the Megillah Esther's scroll, but maybe we have listeners here. You know, maybe it's their first time. So once upon a time, you know, in a palace, there was a Jewish queen called Esther. She was married to a king called Achashverosh. In a way, there was a very, I would say, supreme minister called Haman. He decided to kill all the Jews in the kingdom. And that was the first time Esther had to reveal the fact she is a Jewish girl. Her husband, you know, he knew nothing about her identity. She decided, that was, I think, the game changer. When Esther decided, I'm part of my nation, although I can hide my identity, I can save myself and, you know, ignore my people out there. I don't want to do it. And you know, when her uncle Mordechai, he asked her to help, he didn't beg. It's very interesting to say. I think that's one of the scenes that are very important for Jews today. We do not beg for help. Mordechai was very, I think he came with a lot of self-confidence, with a lot of, you know, Jewish pride. He told her, listen, Esther, the Jewish people will survive. It's going to be okay. It's your decision. If you will remain silent, you will be forgotten. We will find, you know, with God's help, the Jewish people will live forever. It's your decision. I mean, do you want to be a spectator or a player? Do you want to become active and do something about it? And her decision was, yeah, I want to do something. She asked him to gather all the Jews, Lech Knoset Kol HaYehudim, Jewish unity, to pray, to daven, to fast this week on Thursday, Ta'anit Esther, day of fasting. I'll just say in Israel, many mothers of the hostages, they said, don't call it this year. Don't call it Ta'anit Esther. Call it Ta'anit Romi. I know Romi's mother, Romi Bat Merav. Merav is the mother. Romi is 23. She's now in Gaza. And we will fast not just for Esther that was, you know, captive in a foreign palace, for Romi that is now under foreign regime, evil regime in Gaza. So many of the, not just Ta'anit Romi, it's also Ta'anit Daniela, Ta'anit Na'ama, names of Israeli girls, you know, young soldiers or girls that were celebrating, dancing at the festival, the Nova party, and they're now there. So in a way, I think it's meaningful when we speak about, you know, Ta'anit Esther this year, it's going to be really meaningful this coming Thursday. And then I think what really changed Haman's decision to kill us was the way Esther built her plan. We were out there, we the Jewish people, were praying, davening for the first time together with Jewish, I would say, solidarity and unity. She was in there with the king, Achashverosh, and in a way that is, as I said, not miraculous, in a normal way, you know, in a hidden way, there's a real king. It's not King Achashverosh, it's the real king, God, that was, you know, the real director of the whole plot. And at the end of the day, happy end comes when Esther is doing the right thing in there, in the palace. We are out there, the Jewish people. And at the end of the Megillah, it says, "LaYehudim haita ora v'simcha v'sason v'ikar." The Jewish people had joy. They were happy and they had honor. They had, you know, they got their pride again, in a way. And they realized who they are, what's their mission. But it ends when they're still there in exile, diaspora in Shushan, in Persia. So it's not the end of the story. You know, Israel is the direction for them. But still, this story symbolizes, I think for us today, there are so many messages we can learn that are so relevant for what's going on right now.
It's interesting, though, because this is one of very, very, very few sources in our scriptures that don't mention God at all.
As a journalist, I identified with this text, I think, because God is hidden. And this is our mission to find him, you know, behind the scenes. He's there, always. He's always with us, you know, takes care of what's going on. But it's not like in the Torah, the scroll, it's a different type of text where you have to find your own Megillat Esther. By the way, in Hebrew, I won't teach you, your listeners, the real Ivrit right now. But yeah, Megillah, it's from the word Gilu, it reveals something. Esther is from the word hidden, to hide something. So this combination of Gilui veHester, of hidden things that are seen and not seen. Do you see him behind the scenes? And I once heard it from Rabbi Adin Steinzels. He said, we should all write our own Megillat Esther. It's our mission to look at your life, okay? From the day you were born until today, it's your Megillat Esther, okay? God is there with you. If you see him, sometimes you don't. But look at the Megillah. We read it in 15 or 20 minutes in shul when we go to synagogue to listen to the story. But in real life, it took 11 years. Do you see him always? You know, look at the last 11 years of your life. It's your Megillah. It's your plot. And I hope we will all have, just like in the real Megillah, a happy end. But it means we have to look and find and seek and search the messages. You know, sometimes it's hidden. That's a real message for us as modern Jews, yeah. I suggest now we'll go into the tachlas. Is it okay? four mitzvot, four commandments. When you look at Purim, there are many customs, like the costumes, like the Haman Tashan, the way you call it in English, in Ivris, in Yiddish, we call it Oznei Haman. Anyway, these are all customs, the real halakha, the real things you're supposed to do as responsible Jews. We have four missions. The first thing is Seudat Purim, to enjoy a festive meal with family, friends. That's it, a simple concept. We know on, you know, Leila Seder, Seder night, we do it, and then we do it with matzot. Why not doing it with bread 30 days earlier? A nice seudah during Sunday, during Purim, having a seudat Purim, drinking, singing, discussing the Megillah, and discussing the current Megillah that is now written. We're now writing a new chapter in the Bible, what's going on right now. That's the first easy mitzvah. Eat and be happy. The second mitzvah, the circle is now becomes wider. It's not just us, the intimate sphere, the family. It's the people surrounding us, the community, the friends. It's called Mishloach Manot, giving a gift, sending, or Shalach Manas in Ivris, giving a gift or a basket or something to a foreign person, to someone that is, it's not part of your family. Two edible items, basically, according to the halakha, and that's enough. You can give more mishlochim, more gifts. I think this year, try to be creative. Try to find someone maybe you're not in touch with, maybe an old person or that lives by himself. But maybe in Israel, there's a whole campaign going to families of hostages, going to hotels for the misplaced, the evacuees, going to wounded soldiers in hospitals. That's the right direction this year. If you want to give mishloach manot, really, that's the task this year. The third circle is, after we were with the family members, now with the neighbors, community. Now let's go even, you know, more to a wider circle, to those who are in need. Matanot la'evyonim, giving gifts to the poor, those who are in lack. They don't have enough money. They can't afford themselves to celebrate Purim. Help them. See them. That's the right direction. If you want to reach happiness, give. Don't get. And once again, unfortunately, for so many people, this year, the clock stopped on October 7th. Also financially, I mean, I help this year when I do Matanot La'evyonim, when I try to find people that are really in need, they want to work and they can't. Things change for them in the north, in the south, in Israel. So once again, you have the opportunity maybe of supporting people that, you know, they need your help. It's a huge, your privilege to help others. And now the fourth circle, the Jewish nation. Megillat Esther, the fourth mitzvah, is to read the scroll, to be connected to the wider story, to the big story, essential story. I just heard a beautiful definition this week from Rav Doron Perez. Unfortunately, his son this week was identified. The family thought he's in Gaza. They treated him as a hostage, as a kidnapped soldier. And this week, unfortunately, they declared him a casualty of war. He was buried in Har Herzl, the military cemetery in Israel. His father gave a beautiful definition. He was asked, how can you celebrate Purim? He said, the best way for me is micro and micro, meaning the tiniest thing is to be focused on this moment. Right now, yeah, I have to bury my son, to sit Shiva. I have to be focused on what I'm supposed to do as a father, as a husband, and as a bereaved father. The tiniest details, what's going on, this moment, right here, right now, this day. Micro mean, it's the largest story ever. I'm part of the most magnificent, I'm part of the big Jewish story. I'm writing a chapter, I'm part of the Jewish nation, and I feel it with me. So in a way, when we read Megillat Esther, we all feel like we are Mordechai and Esther right now, fighting ultimate evil, identifying ultimate evil, not just in Israel. When you fight anti-Semitism, when you explain, you know, our policy, part of, you know, Israel's advocacy, when you're connected, when you learn more Torah, every tiny thing you do there is part of our Iron Dome, in a way, it helps. So yeah, connecting yourself to this ancient text of the Megillah. I think these four, it's the prescription we need right now. Seriously, four things we can do this week on Sunday in order to help ourselves and the world. That's the Purim's cure, remedy for us.
So each episode of this here podcast will end with a practical takeaway, a bit of homework in the best way possible, something for our listeners to take with them into the week and to really, really ponder. This week, just to recap, it's going to be observe the four commandments of Purim. First of all, hold the Seudat Purim. Invite someone you haven't seen for a very, very long time. You know, hang with friends, have a good time, discuss everything that's going on in the world. You know you need someone to talk to. Second of all, do shlach munis. Reach out to someone who could use a basket full of delicious food, maybe something to drink as well. Have a good time with that. Third of all, charity. Give some matanot le'evyonim, some gifts for the poor, for those truly in need. Maybe it's a donation to a soup kitchen. Maybe it's just, you know, a little bit of money for someone in your neighborhood, in your life, who you know could use the help. And fourth of all, go hear the timeless story of how in every generation we are persecuted, and in every generation, with God's help, we prevail. And with that, there's only one thing to say to conclude this week's episode. Before we return next week, before we jump right in to the book of Leviticus, one of the most splendid and unbelievably misunderstood works of genius, and that thing is Sivan Rav Meir. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. May you have a happy Purim. Purim Sameach.
Subscribe to Sivan Says wherever you listen to podcasts. That's spelled S-I-V-A-N-S-A-Y-S. That's it for our Shabbat episode. Unorthodox is a production of Tablet Studios. The show is usually hosted by me, Stephanie Butnick, with Leah Leibovitz and Joshua Molina. We're always produced and edited by Josh Cross, Robert Scaramuccia, Quinn Waller, and Ellie Blyer. And our team includes Tanya Singer and Courtney Hazlett, with help from Sam Hacker and Jordana LaRosa. Our episode art is by Esther Werdiger. Our logo is by Jenny Rosbrook, who also made our beautiful, beautifully Jewish logo. Our theme music is by Golem, and the performance of Lecha Dodi that you heard on this episode is by Rabbi Josh Warshawski. We love to hear from you. Email us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or leave a message on our listener line, 914-570-4869. Until next week, Shabbat Shalom, friends.